And with that, let's get on to our first case study. And please, again, reminding you folks, if you have anything to say about these, let us know. So the Vatican doesn't like short sellers. This is a really interesting document that I came across a few months ago. The Vatican, if you're not aware, I wasn't aware, actually releases periodically statements on the financial regulation in the entire world. It's pretty. They have a pretty well thought out in the sense of complete view of financial regulation. And one of the things that they singled out in this document, which is the title is in Latin, and so I'm not going to pretend to be able to pronounce it, but I'll read the quote. Which you can too, read along. In fact, the process of acquiring instruments, and this being financial instruments, here they're talking about credit default swaps, by those who do not have any risk already in existence, creates a unique case in which persons start to nurture interest for the ruin of other economic entities and can even resolve themselves to do so. The point here is that when you don't have any skin in the game and you don't have an insurable interest, to use some jargon that we're more familiar with, then to actually take out an insurance policy on something that isn't going to harm you directly is wrong. And that's interesting. So the obvious counterexample to this, or the example with violating this Catholic doctrine, is short selling on stocks. Now, there isn't an example of that in the insurance business. And I think that the comparison between the financial markets, let's call it, and insurance in this case is interesting, because we don't do that. And there is a, call it an informal, if only informal, doctrine within the insurance business of needing to have insurable interest involved in, if you're going to buy an insurance policy, it has to be something that's going to harm you directly. And so what I was curious about is, and I'll turn it over to the panel in a moment, is how this might interact with the precepts. And the precept that I came up with thinking about this was precept one, which is all about preserving the reputational integrity of the actuarial profession. Would that be violated by participating in a financial transaction for which there is not any insurable interest? Panelists, what do you guys think?
Okay. So David touched upon a lot of important concepts. I just want to, make maybe a connection with that. One was he mentioned insurable interests. I think that's very key. And when we started talking briefly about this topic, one thing that came to my mind was just, the 2008 financial crisis, and how, credit default swaps and whatnot were used. The initial idea behind credit default swaps was a good one, but it became a financial instrument, but certainly it was not insurance per se. And so what happened was, a lot of people started buying these, but it became basically, contracts that was extremely leveraged against, an entity going out of business, really. And so in some ways, like, that idea of a short seller, here you're buying credit default swap in the hopes that it's going to go up in value, but you're not really short selling the company's debt per se, as opposed to short selling a company's stock, which you would actually potentially influence the stock price. So I just wanted to kind of bring that out as kind of like an idea. So to distinguish between influencing a stock price as opposed to influencing the valuation of a company's default risk.
Right, and we also, we run into this a lot, from a, when I was a consultant, we would run into this because we were not supposed to maintain any financial interest in any of the companies, any direct financial interest anyhow, in any of the companies that we were opining on. I was dealing with a company in Boston back in about 4 or 5 years ago now, and we knew there was something wrong there, and we were raising reserves significantly. And at some point, they acknowledged that there was a problem, although they did not believe that the problem was as big as we knew it was. And that led to some interesting discussions. And, and one of the things that, from an actuary standpoint, you can get involved in, there was definitely information that I knew about where that company was going, that if I had owned stock, I would have been likely to dispose of it. I never owned it, so I never disposed of it. And I never short sold it either. Because there were just some crazy things going on with the way they were looking at the world, and it was different than we were looking at the world as well. So it's definitely one of these things where you want to make sure that you are always operating at the highest morals, and I think avoiding the owner, I think it loops back to this in terms of avoiding the ownership of companies that you're going to opine on, and making sure that in certain cases, I guess, if you worked for that company and you own stock, you have to make sure that you're not operating in a way that would violate any of these precepts.
One thing that's occurred to me as kind of underlying reasoning here for both call it the insurance principle and the Catholic principle is, in this is, I think, maybe a bit interesting difference, because in insurance, I think of this doctrine as protecting the seller of insurance. So if you're selling something to somebody and they don't have anything at stake, then they're going to screw you, probably, or find a way to do that and claim on that policy without actually needing the money. But the Catholic Church, I think, is making the opposite, has the opposite concern, because they're concerned that by selling them something, you're going to try and screw them by forcing some kind of loss on them. And that doesn't seem to be kind of trying to get at something a little bit different. But I'd like to see if I could take the discussion in a little bit of a different direction, and that comes down to an external party, call it an institution that a certain number of people in the world revere and take a lot of moral guidance from. And let's say there's an actuarial act or something in the insurance business that we're doing that the Vatican disapproves of. Should we have a problem with that? There's an external kind of moral authority that would cause us to violate precept one by saying, no, you guys shouldn't do that, but it might be a common practice amongst actuaries. How much should we care about other people?
Well, I think as long as you're acting in the best interest of the profession, and obviously it also depends on, well, what is your relationship with the Vatican or with anyone else at that time, because you need to always consider the interest of your principal, the person who hired you. If you're an employee of a company, it's them. If you're a consultant, it's the company that hired you, but I think you have to look at it, from that standpoint as well.
Tom, any thoughts there?
I think we had a comment or
a question. In the back.
Yeah, so I was just going to say that the situation described before about short-selling stocks where you have information because of your job, I think that would be considered illegal in America. I think it would be people...
If you had insider information,
Yeah.
I
think that was
yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. No. But what if you didn't have insider information?
Well, you did have insider information. The point about the Vatican I was going to ask is, when it says any risk of credit already, does that mean the Vatican is saying it's okay to short sell as part of hedging or arbitrage within a portfolio, but not on an exploitative basis?
Yeah, interesting point. I don't know the answer to that question offhand. But maybe. Yeah?
Yeah, in fact, I think the interesting component of that is the next sentence where they speak to nurturing interests. Mm. The real life situation with short sellers, and we see this all the time, whether you're an actuary or not, are short sellers who've been actively campaigning.
Sure.
Put out this information about the company.
Yep.
That's what I think we're addressing.
Yeah. If you believe Elon Musk, the short sellers are sabotaging his factories and. Yeah.
I'm thinking about some of the aggressive stock analysts.
Sure.
In our industry is somewhat unique because of the availability of information that can be interpreted in so many different ways. Right? The statutory information that goes out, that doesn't necessarily tell the entire story. And it's very easy for an actuary particularly to color that in a particular way. You've seen it. Mm-hmm. You put out information beforehand. Hey, I believe the company X is under reserve by so many dollars. You
influence.
Whether they are or not, but
yep.
I put out that information and I'm a short seller. Right?
Yeah.
I'm acting in my own interest.
Well, I think the ambiguity of actuarial work is certainly going to be a theme here. Maybe we can move on to the next slide.
Actually, just real quickly.
Go ahead, Tom.
So just to kind of finish that out a little bit. So I wanted to make a slight distinction between like short selling by actually shorting a stock, like based on public information, right? So like maybe you want to say like, well, I think the industry overall is under-reserved, and therefore I think insurance stocks in general is going to go down, okay? Versus something like, you know, not necessarily influencing the stock price specifically, for example, just buying puts or something like that. So to your point, you were saying like it's a hedge. I think a hedge is a very good, valid way of protecting your interests. So I think if you had, you know, the underlying stock and you were just buying the puts as a hedge, that makes also perfect sense and it's very ethical. But would it also be ethical if you didn't necessarily have the underlying stock and you just wanted to buy the put because you think it will go up in value? I think that's a, you know, it's a prudent move financially. I don't think it's necessarily perhaps morally wrong, and it certainly wouldn't violate anything based upon public information.
I don't see that any different than buying a stock because I believe the value is going to
be lower. Sure. Right, exactly.
Right, it's the
exactly.
same thing.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that's what I mean. So when we say short selling, there's different ways to short sell. It's kind of my distinction, that's all.
Yeah. And I think, you know, coming back to the precepts, like the rule that, I mean, if there's possibly a rule of action that you can apply and trying to adhere to precept one, which is a reputational, it's kind of pretty fuzzy. Maybe it's as long as you don't think that the people who don't like what you're doing are right, then you can carry on. You know, you have to form your own opinion about your own actions. And so what's interesting about this, what I thought was interesting about this precept is that it introduces kind of a third party moral arbiter, which is like the reputation of the profession, which is bigger than an individual. And that, in some ways, I think, is a bit of tension between that and the rest of it, which is all about, you know, what do you think is going on? What do you think the principal wants? So there's very much kind of a personal intimacy there. And then this kind of brings in the rest of the world a little bit, and it's unique from the code in that sense. Okay, move on? Okay, provocative title. Is lying wrong? Obviously, lying is wrong. You would tell me. Of course. But, so let me read about this. So this is from a Matt Levine email. So Matt Levine is a financial commentator, writes for Bloomberg. Highly recommend you read his stuff. It's really entertaining, really interesting. Particularly, it winds up talking about a lot of moral kind of topics. Don't let that dissuade you from reading his work. So Litvak was a bond trader, a mortgage bond trader, who would buy bonds from one customer and sell them to another customer and lie to one or both about the price he was getting on the other side. And he went to trial. He was indicted for this and convicted of a bunch of counts of fraud, but in the second trial, he convicted of fraud only for a single trade. So that's probably an extreme example of this kind of behavior, but I am a reinsurance broker, and by profession, also an actuary, engage in what you might think of adversarial negotiations pretty frequently. And the code is quite clear that you shouldn't lie. But in any kind of negotiation where you're trying to discover a price, there's all sorts of posturing that goes on, and you mislead deliberately people to sort of as part of the price discovery mechanism. I think that human negotiating is a little bit of a duplicitous act. And I feel okay about that personally because I think that it's just necessary in order for people to believe that they get the right deal for themselves. But that seems to me to run a little bit contra to the actuarial code of conduct, or could be perceived as such. Eric, Tom, thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, a couple of things with any situation like this, and I think it comes along the range of reasonable results in a way, in that you need to come up with a number that makes sense to both parties, but you don't want to be in a position where you're lying to either of them, and that can be, you know, that can be a very difficult spot. Obviously, you know, your responsibility is to, you know, your principal, and this kind of ties back to what we said in the first one, where your responsibility is to the person that hired you to provide the right information. So if you're on both sides of this transaction and can't do that honestly, you probably shouldn't be doing it as an actuary. You can probably do it as a bond trader, but you probably shouldn't be doing it as an actuary.
Sure. Tom, any thoughts?
Yeah, so, I mean, one thought that I had when I read this was, a real estate agent. So in one of my real estate transactions, you know, I hired this broker, represented me, so she would get the usual 6%. But in turn, she actually found the seller as well. And so here she was playing, you know, the dual role, right? You know, just to try to get that right price to, so that both can make a deal. And so, you know, she said as little as she could, and I tried to get as much information as I could, certainly. The deal eventually, you know, worked out, but the point here is that, you know, this sounds very similar to that, where she was very clear as to not say anything regarding what their price was going to be. And in turn, we made it clear that she, you know, while we speak, she shouldn't, you know, share any of our conversation with our buyer as well. So it's that sort of like, you know, role where there's a tremendous amount of implicit trust within the broker, and that's exactly what Dave, you know, Dave does day to day. And a lot of times I think just the less they say, the better. And in this case, you know, we didn't really talk about hard price. We just said, well, what's your number? That's the only thing that my broker really needed to know. And that's what we came up with. So to me, that just, you know, it's much more practical. It makes a lot of sense. So that's pretty much my comments on this. And actually, just as a quick pause, just relating to the general session we had, you know, certainly if there's anything here that, you know, we say that doesn't make sense, because, you know, sometimes the lingo that we use, like, I think, you know, Dave used price discovery. Just want to make sure, like, you know, it means something to people. And if there's anything that isn't, please just ask.
Great. Anybody have any thoughts here? Yeah.
I mean, I think everything actuaries engage in involves adversarial negotiation. I mean, you know, companies trying to get a higher premium, and policyholders want lower premium.
Sure.
Reserves, you know, auditors tend to want higher reserves. Management might want lower reserves. I mean, the regulators. So, I think everything an actuary does, there's some sense of adversarial component to it. So,
yeah.
Right. I think that ties into what I was saying in terms of, you know, this continual range of reasonable numbers. You know, there's about 40 people in this room. We could look at a set of reserves for a company and probably come up with 42 different ideas as to what the real reserves are, because a couple of people would have two opinions. You know, but you want to make sure that they're somewhere in the reasonable range. And then, you know, from a reserve standpoint, you know, if you tie it to the reserving side, that's kind of what, if you're asked to opine on someone else's work, that's what you want to be able to do, is to say, yes, what they're doing is reasonable. Not necessarily that's exactly what I would have gotten if I had done it, but what they're doing is reasonable. And that to me is, it's a little bit of a different situation than the instant case, but I think that's how it kind of ties back to the reserve world.
And you could argue that a range of reserve opinions is an infinite number of opinions. Sure.
The code of conduct.
Yep.
And so there may be certain things that those who are not held to that code of conduct would do in that negotiation that we as actuaries should not.
Yep. And I'll draw kind of a connection here between conservatism, which is a form of bias, which is a form of lying. Right? And so you think of, like, when you're being very conservative about something, what you are is you're deliberately selecting something that's on one side of the distribution than another, which in some ways can be misleading because, and it, you know, comes back to some other precepts about interpretation, choosing your audience, and defining kind of the scope in which you want certain opinions to be evaluated. But, you know, I think that it's the right answer that I think we've come to here is that it's sort of inherent in what we do, a certain amount of it. And once again, you got to use your judgment on whether you're comfortable.
Let me ask you one thing, David. In your role as a broker and an actuary, does that put you at a disadvantage to people who are just brokers without actuarial credentials because of that?
Does it make it
more difficult?
So let me answer the question this way. I don't ever think about the code of conduct when I am broking, right? But you have your own internal kind of moral compass, which says, do I feel good about what I'm doing or not? And that's really what I really rely on. And I think that the best salesmen on earth are really honest people and honest salesmen. And you find a way to convey the uncertainty about a position without misleading anybody. But that's delicate work, I think, very delicate work, particularly when you're worried that you might influence something unduly with some statement you make. I mean, you can misspeak And, you know, that's a mistake. That's not a lie, but that might, you know, you can sort of set the snowball down the wrong side of the hill, and then suddenly you can lose a deal. So it's not easy. It's not easy. But that is almost a separate point from whether, you know, whether an actuary can do it. I mean, I don't feel there's conflict at all. I think that being an actuary helps me understand more deeply other people's perspectives on a problem, and that helps in a negotiation. Yep. Yeah, I think there's probably like some more like concrete statements of like actually lying about something or other. You know, this person said this to me and that was untrue, as opposed to you can be a lot more. I mean, this guy's probably just actually an idiot as well. I think that you don't necessarily need to actually state untruths and give the impression of something being other than what it is, which is a little bit more gray. And I mean, this guy probably just did something dumb. But in some ways, the extreme examples are helpful. So taking a bit of license there.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think the gray area, and I do the same thing, I'm in the reentry program, I think the gray area is kind of the deceit and misrepresentation of data. Like,
sure.
You have a whole range of assumptions, but if you don't tell the other parties what was taken out of the data,
yep.
Or we're only going to show 5 years of data instead yep. of 10, that's where it gets really gray. And me personally, I like to be transparent and say, hey, we took this up, here's why, here's my assumptions, let me know what you think. But I think the gray area is what you hide.
Mm-hmm.
And brokers tend to, oh, it's old years of crap, let's throw those out.
Yeah.
Let's just show 5 years.
Yeah.
So I struggle with that.
Yeah, I agree with that too. Yeah.
It seems like there is a distinction too in terms of what you're doing as an actuary, because as an example, let's suppose I've got a second business and I'm a cleaner, something completely unrelated to being an actuary. The fact that I'm an actuary doesn't really, I think, impose on what I'm doing as an operator of a franchise.
Sure. Yeah, and I think the definition of an actuarial work product is a really important part of this. And you can have a pretty strong definition of that, which would be anything an actuary does, which is, in some probably circumstances, not an unreasonable definition of what an actuarial work product is. That's a tricky one, too. If an actuary shows up and, you know, if my credential is in my signature, email signature, and I'm negotiating, but not as an actuary, as something else, like, what is that? A little bit ambiguous. Yeah. Yep.
So a broker, I assume, is a professional conduct.
Sure.
So you're not, I mean, anything you do, you're still subject.
Yeah, I think that no matter what I do, I believe it this way. I need to think about the code of conduct. And if I don't want to, you know, I feel like I would need to make a point in some circumstances about this. This is me talking to you as a broker, or I haven't, you know, you can get out of it in some ways, but out of it, I mean, you can establish your, you know, the frame in which you're evaluating this by saying, I haven't looked at this. You know, we have an actuarial team that's doing it, and I'm not part of that today. I'm just relaying some information to you. Or, you know, it comes down, to, I think, to how you feel about it. Again, anything else? No.
Well, I won't judge you, but I'd be very careful.
Yeah.
If you're an actuary and you're handing somebody an actuarial analysis, I don't think you can wash your hands of it.
Yeah. Fair point. Anybody else? Next. Okay, so this is about, here's an interesting point or historical episode where there was certain kinds of transactions, reinsurance transactions, that were declared at some point to be, to be off limits, I suppose. But there's a pretty healthy market in that before that. And there's a, you know, there's a pretty big gray area in defining what is and is not finite deal, or, you know, these kinds of transactions were designed in some ways perfectly legitimately, in other ways to manipulate financial statements. And in the mid-90s, they came down with a pretty significant ruling about what we needed to do to consider risk transfer having occurred in a reinsurance deal. Eric, this is something that you had a lot of direct experience in. You want to tell a bit more of the story?
Yeah, one of the companies I worked with for about 6 years was a company called Center Re. Unfortunately, I probably started working there about 2 or 3 years too late based on the finances of the company. But the you know, CentaRe was the pioneer in something that was known as finite risk reinsurance. And for probably half the people in this room, that's something from the history books. But for others who may remember it, basically the whole idea behind finite risk reinsurance was that you would buy a policy, and these were usually for very large limits and are generally dealt only with very large deals. And the whole idea would be to preserve the cash flow and to preserve the balance sheet. So if you would have, they would basically be under a situation where you would get paid back, Center would get paid back if they paid out a loss over the course of the next X number of years. So for example, if you know a company suffered a $40 million loss due to a devastating fire in their plant, Center would pay them the $40 million in, you know, at the time of the loss, and the contract was written in a way that over the next 4 or 5 years, the company would then repay that money plus their premium that was due as well. So over time, the only risk Center really had was credit risk. And this was a wonderful business because of that. So wonderful that the accounting profession looked at it and said, well, really, should this be considered reinsurance? They passed an act called Standards Board passed a clause called FAS 113, and that basically eliminated the need. So when you deal with a reinsurance contract now, you're probably very familiar with the terms, you know, 10% chance of a 10% loss, and, you know, uncertainty of not only cash flows, but uncertainty of, you know, whether you can have a loss. And if you don't have that, you don't have reinsurance, and you need to treat it as deposit accounting. So that really changed, the game on Center. But what was being done to that point was perfectly acceptable. In fact, it was brilliant. But when you look back at it now, you know, basically 20 years after FAS 113 came in, actually probably a little bit more now, you say, well, you know, that really changed the way accounting was done. So people were doing something that was 100% correct at the time and now would be considered 100% incorrect.
And that what's particularly interesting to me about this is that there might have been folks who had reservations about it at the time, and they were proven right ultimately, but there were probably more folks who were saying, oh, and I read the law, and we can do this. And it kind of makes you think, like, are there things today that people feel a little uncomfortable with or saying, I think this feels strange to me, or maybe not, or maybe I don't know whether there was a distribution of acceptance or of comfort around dealing with these kinds of deals before FAS 113 came through. I mean, presumably, you know, if CentaRe was the only one doing it, maybe other companies didn't want to do it. Do you know about that, Eric?
Well, there were other companies that were doing it, but CentaRe was the first to do it and, you know, basically became almost a verb, you know, kind of like, you know, Xerox was the verb for copying, Uber is the verb for rideshare. You know, what CentaRe was doing with, finite at that time, you know, they really were, you know, the pioneers in it. And people, you know, over time, before the rules changed, the accounting rules changed, they, you know, started to find, you know, other people that were willing to write, you know, similar deals, because from an insurance company standpoint, you know, your only risk was credit risk. You were going to get back that money as long as the company could pay, and usually you made sure of that by the counterparties that you, selected to insure.
Mm-hmm. Tom, any thoughts?
So maybe as after FAS 113 kind of came into play and most people were getting used to the idea and you know, producing analysis. So I was working on the auditor side of things, and the actuary, actually produced good work, and the numbers looked reasonable. There wasn't that much data, so it actually helped their cause to show that there was, in fact, risk transfer. But what was most interesting to me at the time was that the accountant, and I was working with the accountant and basically under his charge, actually disallowed it. Because, you know, partly maybe because of certain specific things, and I don't necessarily want to get into that aspect, but he actually rejected it, not necessarily from a quantitative perspective, but more from a, you know, business reason perspective, for them to get into this, you know, reinsurance contract. And therefore, you know, he ruled that they had to account for it as deposit counting. And it was partly because there was no business justification for that, even though the numbers themselves proved out that there was risk transfer. Hmm. So just an interesting tidbit from my experience.
Anybody else have any thoughts on that in the audience? Let's move on.
It was before FAS 113, I wouldn't say it was wrong at the time. I mean, it seems like a gray area. I mean, this seems more like a black and white. Murder's wrong, I mean, you don't need a law to say that. But for things like this, I mean, it was brilliant, you said. I mean, it was acceptable for the time. I don't see the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, one. So there are explicit precepts. I didn't actually list them out here that say breaking the law is wrong. That's no surprise. There are a few of them actually that talk about lawbreakers as being violating the code of conduct as well. But I think that the way this can be drawn in is there's obviously an underlying reasoning of why these things are illegal, and I'm wondering whether the precept or the code of conduct mirrors some of the reasoning of what illegal acts are and what things are illegal. I mean, there's a certain amount of, I suppose, cultural forces that drive what becomes legal and not, and that's probably out of scope for the actuarial profession. This being an interesting, I brought it up because I think it's an interesting case of something that people was fairly common practice that became illegal, and so kind of gets the ultimate stamp of disapproval quite quickly, not quickly, but maybe somewhat suddenly. And then, you know, should that have been something that we with our principles, which I'm not sure these principles were in place at the time, maybe could have anticipated? Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yep.
For me, an interesting corollary to this is actuaries working outside the United States, where you see that this rule changed.
Yep. That is a really interesting point. And I think that the code, if I'm right remembering this, I haven't studied up on this part, says that you need to, if you're a fellow of the CAS or associate, then you still need to adhere to this code even if you're in another country. I think I remember reading that somewhere. Or maybe that was a different thing. But that's a funny one, isn't it? Because then you could be out of step with the marketplace in that case and then saying, well, everybody's doing this, so, you know, we need you to do it. Because this is what
right,
business is. Yeah. Yeah. That'd be a tough situation.
Right. If I remember right, there's nothing inherently wrong with the finite redeal.
It's just absolutely not. Yeah.
Very important.
Yeah, it's the accounting treatment. Yeah. These deals do exist to some degree today, but they lost all of their panache when the accounting treatment changed. But I thought you made an excellent point, you know, particularly if we consider it in reverse. For example, what if, you know, some country in the EU had banned this, but it was still legitimate in the United States?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's an interesting way to look at it, and we might see that at some point with some other, you know, financial, you know, mechanism or regulation.
Yeah, and, you know, to the point about it being actually an accounting problem, not necessarily an actuarial problem, you know, does the actuary have control over how this is booked? Maybe they're not. You know, they're part of the analysis of a deal saying, you know, here's the economic benefit, but you got to do a deposited accounting. It still makes sense. And they go ahead and use insurance accounting for it anyway. I imagine that you're going to get brought in front of the judge for that, irrespective of whether you were part of the accounting treatment or not. But the code of conduct, I'm not sure what it would say about that situation. I don't know if anybody else has any thoughts there. Let's move on. So this is one of my favorites. Does disclosure work? So the code of conduct is riddled with disclosure advice requirements, saying disclose all sorts of things, bias, the point there being either be unbiased or try and disclose any bias you might have so to assist in your principal's interpretation of your work or any user's interpretation of your work. But what's interesting about the psychology literature on bias is there's some significant questions about whether disclosure even works as a way of insulating your readers against bias. So here's some just a couple excerpts from a few papers and articles. So Anchoring Bias, Tversky and Kahneman, great book by Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow. I recommend you guys read it. It's pretty awesome. So once advice is let out of the bag, you're anchoring people's impressions around that piece of information, irrespective of whether it's right or not. We just have this tendency to remember something specific and then go back to that. So there's this weird kind of social interaction where, actually that's the third one, sorry. So disclosure may have the effect of sometimes making matters worse. So you're free to actually go the extra mile and be more biased that you disclose it. So like, oh, I'm biased here. And if you hadn't disclosed that, maybe you'd feel a bit more guilty about actually acting on your bias. But now it's disclosed. Like, I'm going to go all the way and let my bias run free. And so the third one here is there's a social interaction. And this is something that's important for salespeople to understand. That once you establish a connection with somebody and you disclose something, even you know, it's almost like the force of the social interaction kind of pushes people towards agreement, even if they know that it's not right or somehow wouldn't beforehand think that's the right thing. So like if I said to you, you know, here's a quick story from my own personal life. So walking down the street near Penn Station in New York City, and a guy walks up to me, and he's kind of a young guy who says, hey, I'm going to sell you this CD. This is 10 years ago or something like that, still selling CDs. And I'm like, I don't want your CD. And he's like, come on, you know, like here, just take it, have a look at it. And he made me grab it. Didn't make me do anything. He just said, grab this, holding it to me. And I grabbed it. And I was like, and I kind of had a moment of, I don't know, sympathy for the guy. I was like, okay, fine. And I was like, and I pulled out my wallet and I was like, here's a couple bucks. And he said, how about you give me that 10? And I gave it to him. And I was like, why the hell did I just do that? I just gave him a $10 bill. I was going to give him
sucker.
A $10 bill.
Sucker.
Absolutely a sucker. Totally. And he walked away, and I was like, man, I just got totally, totally played there. But it was this, because he was, you know, I don't know, it's the way he was a brilliant con artist, I suppose. But there's that the social interaction made me want to agree with this guy, even though he did not have my interest at heart. I did listen to the CD. It was terrible after the fact. I felt compelled to give him the money that I didn't want to give him at first. And so that's a weird kind of interaction effect there where bias can, even though you're disclosing it, doesn't necessarily work. So that's the whole theme here is that how good is disclosing bias at actually removing bias? Is it effective or not? So I was talking for a while. Eric, what do you think?
So should we play some three-card Monty after the presentation? But I think, you know, this whole concept of disclosure, I think, you know, when I've worked with, you know, larger companies, you know, one of the things, the very first thing I think we do whenever we get a new assignment is we end up looking at a conflict check and finding out, well, what potential conflicts do we have if we undertake, you know, if we undertake this assignment and make sure that we have a way of resolving them or else we do not undertake the assignment. And I think that kind of is the first step to, it comes in really before you get to the disclosure step, because now you've got to, you find, well, yeah, I used to work for a company with offices throughout the United States, and we might have a West Coast office that's working with one of your competitors, but we're going to work with you, and you know, we don't believe there's conflict because we're not going to exchange information, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's kind of what you're getting at here, becomes a question of, well, you know, is that a conflict, and is there a need to, clearly there's a need to disclose it, and then it becomes a question of, you know, is the potential principal in your arrangement confident and comfortable that they want to proceed, and only then would you proceed, and sometimes even then, you know, depending on the company you're working for, some companies are very, would be even more careful and would not, you know, allow an engagement like that to proceed. But I think, you know, the whole disclosing, you know, who you're working for and what you're doing and, you know, anything that would potentially bias what you're going to result in, you know, I think is important.
Tom?
Right. Sometimes perception is reality, as the saying goes. So working at, you know, the big four consulting firms, you know, there's audit work and then there's advisory work, right? So those are, you know, very two separate things. And when I was there, if we were auditing the company, we basically were excluded from advisory work because, in essence, when it came time to audit that advisory work, you couldn't do it. I mean, you could even say, well, we'll put different teams on, or we'll send teams from a different, you know, like London as opposed to New York or something like that. So that sort of thing, the companies themselves said, no, we don't even want to be put in that type of situation. So I think that's an important, you know, distinction, if you will, even though we tried to mitigate it, but most companies wouldn't necessarily even go for it. That's all.
There's one other kind of idea I want to introduce here, and sort of this was in the back of my mind, because nobody's going to say, like, so you say, okay, great point, Dave. So, like, what does that mean? We don't disclose bias now? Like, of course, that's not the point, right? So you still have to disclose these things. But what's interesting about the code of conduct here is that, for the most part, the code of conduct is what I call principles-based regulation. And no, I don't call that. That's what people who know more about it than me call it. And so that's saying, here's an idea that you need to comply with. And in some cases, they do what we think of it, what people call rules-based regulation. It's like, here's three or four things you must do. And the anti-bias section of the code is very rules-based. So it says, if this, then that. If this, disclose that. Disclose this principle, do this, do this. They don't actually come out anywhere and make a principles-based proclamation against bias. So they don't say, protect your clients against biased work, or something like that, some big general statement, right? Because to protect the clients against biased work, this kind of stuff wouldn't start mattering, because you're like, well, hang on a minute, does disclosure even work? But instead they say, don't disclose this, disclose that. If you feel like you're conflicted, just tell them, and then keep doing the work. But I think that maybe overlooks the fact that you're not safe from bias, and what's the point of all this? And the point of all this, of course, is so the principal can make an unbiased decision for themselves on what they want to do, And I think what I'm kind of criticizing here implicitly is the ability for a rule that you can apply to actually deal properly with bias, with your own bias. And I think that we are all biased. I think it's actually pretty hard. It's not always obvious to easy to identify what your biases might be. But, you know, you could argue that the opposite of bias isn't unbiased. It's actually complete ignorance of something. So as soon as you know something, you have your own personal history. And so you don't want to go kind of too far down that track. But the idea of actually getting rid of bias, I think, is a little bit too ambitious, is my thinking there.
Right. I think in terms of just tying it back to, you know, the code of conduct, you know, disclose, disclose, disclose. You'll never get yourself in trouble with the code of conduct by disclosing something in terms of, you know, something that you might be in the gray area about. Do I really have to tell them this? If you're asking a question, do you really have to tell them this? You have to tell them this.
Yeah. Anybody have any thoughts in the audience? We can move on. So here's another bias case, I suppose. So again, this is from another Matt Levine email. And so this is interesting, again, from the financial markets, where if you are trading in stock, you will have, let's say you're running a mutual fund, for example, and you're gonna buy research on whatever it is that you're studying, the industry or whatever it would have you, and you're also going to buy securities from a broker. And both of those channels provide you with information on what you should do. The difference is that the broker is giving the information away for free, quote unquote, but is biased. And then the research analyst they're charging you for it. In these days, I guess, I mean, I'm not too familiar with how the economics work, but you have to pay them for that research, and therefore you're a little less concerned about it. And so there's a regulation that was being proposed. I don't know actually if it went through, whereby they're prohibiting or considering prohibiting any trading entity or call it a mutual fund from getting advice that isn't free. And so it's ironic, as the point goes, is that can they only ever get information from people that they're charging them for that information, or should you be able to get information from elsewhere? The point there to try and remove bias. What's interesting about that, I think, tying it back to our business, is all the time, you know, we are talking, you're trying to deliver opinions on things, and again, myself as a broker, people ask you for advice. An insurance client will say, what should I do in this situation? often enough, my answer is buy reinsurance from me, from my company. I believe that's true, of course. But, you know, is that information, you know, it is biased. Do they appreciate that bias or not? Guys, any thoughts?
Well, how is that any different from what, you know, currently the regulators are doing, right? So S&P, AM Best, Moody's, I mean, who pays for that credit rating? It's the companies themselves, that's all. So they have to, again, so going back to your bias thing, I mean, they know which, you know, which who's buttering the bread, if you will. And I think sometimes, that's why, like, a lot of times they keep the ratings as high as, you know, where they are. They don't downgrade, if you will, unless they absolutely, I think, have to. So again, it's just a general comment, but that's pretty much what goes on with the regulators right now, really. And again, you know, going back to, you know, the past crises that we had, I mean, a lot of them were still investment grades until it wasn't the next day. So, and that's when, you know, the you know, whatever, the horses already left the barn, if you will.
Right, you can definitely see that, you know, with a lot of these, you know, if you were to do a analysis of or a review of failed insurance companies, you would certainly see that, because a lot of these companies, you know, while you'll see some companies that were, you know, in bad shape for a while and were just kind of hanging on, it's also very common to see a company that was an A-plus company one day and a B-minus company the next day. And, you know, that means that either a lot of really bad news hit in 24 hours or, you know, that they were holding on into a spot where they felt they weren't comfortable enough to hold on, you know, to that rating. You know, and then they felt like they were forced to, you know, to lower it. You know, but you're certainly right that companies pay for, you know, the privilege of being rated by, you know, by the large, you know, rating organization. So there is definitely a, there definitely is somewhat of a bias, because the company that you're rating is also a client in that sense. You know, but they have an obligation more in that sense to the public to be, you know, as forthright as they can. And sometimes, you know, the information just isn't known. You know, I've worked with, some companies that, you know, we were brought in after the company was, you know, taken over by a state. And when you look back at what was known, you know, a month, 3 months, 6 months before that, internally there were issues that people knew about, but it hadn't reached the external world yet. And then when it did, the whole thing, you know, collapsed, and there was, you know, the company ended up getting taken over. And in one particular case, the people that were orchestrating it ended up in prison.
Ouch. Anybody else? So move on from bias to another idea. So here, this is something that I find is kind of interesting. Again, comparing what actuaries do, forecasting analysts to other analysts and other businesses. We don't talk about skill, or we don't talk about track records very much. And that is absolutely central to your business if you are running a stock portfolio or any other, call it financial analyst, business. And the question, I suppose, is if you have a better track record than another actuary, should you promote that fact? Or, you know, saying, I am the most accurate reserving analyst on earth, one, you know, and I can measure it, and here's proof. That's not something that I've ever seen. I don't know if anybody else has. The precepts come in, potentially, here, is if there's a difference of opinion among actuaries, you should try and conduct it objectively, which in some ways would support this, because you could say, Actuary A over here has no idea what he's talking about, because he's wrong on all his, on those opinions, and I'm right on mine. And so is that not an objective agreement? This is something I think violates some of the spirit of our culture as actuaries, where we don't really like to publicly disagree with other actuaries, certainly not on outcomes. Maybe you can have a conversation about methods and maybe come to some sort of common understanding of the truth, but an actual discussion of skill is, I think, completely absent. Guys, what do you think?
Well, I think the first thing you run into with that, you know, is, you know, covered in the code, where you need to address differences. The first thing, if you have a difference with another actuary, you're supposed to go address that difference with them first. You know, so from that standpoint, you know, some of these differences, you're not supposed to issue a paper you know, Joe actuary doesn't know what they're talking about. You know, the reserves are $20 million higher. You're supposed to go talk to Joe and see if you can, you know, get an understanding. And, you know, I think it goes back to what we said, you know, one of the earlier slides, where there can and will be a difference of opinion between various actuaries on just about any risk. It's very hard to find two people that will agree on all the underlying numbers, you know, concerning a risk, particularly anything that's remotely complex. So I think that's something that you have to do. But I do agree with David in that you never see people advertising, you know, in public, you know, come to the, you know, the Eric Consulting Firm, we give you the best results. You know, that doesn't make any sense in our world. You know, but I do think that, you know, any actuary would, you know, in the purses of a, you know, say a job interview or something like that, would go in and sell their, you know, sell what they're doing. That could be a job interview for a job with a principal or as a consultant, saying, well, you know, here's what I can do for you. But I don't think you get that best or worst type response, because I'm not sure that really exists.
Dom? Oh, sorry, audience question. Yeah, sure.
Well, I think they're, sure. You know, I think some of them are, you know, in terms of getting a better methodology, but that's not, you know, the software is not the actuary, or at least it shouldn't be. You know, there is, you know, the actuary has programmed some of the softwares in some cases, or with other, you know, CS professionals, you know, has, you know, gone through that programming. But I don't think any of them really will say, you know, here's the best results,
right.
Because I don't think they can.
Yeah, if I can take that, since I actually work at a software vendor.
How's your software, Tom? Best?
Tom's is the best. You know, there's no question about
no
that.
No competition.
So, and you raise a really good point, because we actually go out of our way to say that there's no software that's best. You buy a software mainly for one customer service, right? You know, you're dealing with the people. And certainly, you know, having the trust and being comfortable with the people and the responsiveness. And two, it's about usability. You know, am I able to transfer my data from here into your platform, if you will, and then get data back? It's you know, for me, those are kind of the more important metrics, because being best, I honestly can't tell you what that means, because best is going to be different for everybody. The point, though, is that the methodology should be the same, right? You know, like if you're gonna, for example, simulate a loss reserve distribution, you use a log normal, you've got parameters, you should get exactly the same distribution out. You know, it doesn't matter what software you're using. You could be doing it in Excel, really. So there is no best. I think it's these other dimensions that make a lot more sense, and it's much more objective. And that's what we usually tell everybody.
Okay. Go ahead.
That does make a difference. And
sure.
That kind of mudslinging is, I think, what we as an industry should be trying to protect ourselves from. We don't want to be seen by the rest of the world as, you know, throwing mud at ourselves. And so that's part of treating each other with respect.
Go ahead. Yeah, sorry, guys. A lot of hands up. Yeah.
It's very easy to do.
Measurement's easy. Yeah.
I mean, that's all public information. Whereas the actuaries, if I'm like, oh, I'm pricing, you know, the Marriott account, I mean, I'm probably using a lot of confidential data that I can't share if others don't have the. So, I mean, if you could do this on the same basis, I think it would be reasonable to do. But I just think a lot of the work that we do makes it very difficult to make it analogous to what stock analysts are doing.
Mm-hmm. We had a question over on this side a minute ago, though.
Hopefully, if you're using the same
Sure.
The difference between the actuary and the that person picking stocks or professional gambler, they're independent of that.
So when we interview, we ask people, hey, tell us about times you made efficiencies. We ask about track records like that. I think this is track record of, hey, you guess the reserve.
What's interesting, too, is that we're in a lot of ways we're dancing around the kind of the real thing, which is what is somebody, maybe not, I don't know, what are they buying? Are they buying a forecast or are they buying a process as a client of any sort, of any of us? And I think implicit in this is that we think, in this conversation here, is that we think they're buying a process, not necessarily an outcome, which is interesting, I think. Yeah? Right. What's your track record? What's your track record? I mean, you'd think that some enterprising lawyer might come up with that question. I don't know that it's happened. Yep, back there. I would distinguish the actuarial profession from the financial analyst profession. So I'm a chartered financial analyst as well, did that designation. And there's a whole section in the exam process there about measuring results and saying, here's how you measure results, the right ways to measure results. There's like dollar weighting and time weighted averages and all this kind of stuff. And you go through a lot of it, of how should you do this properly. So though it is, at least the data is available, it's not necessarily straightforward. We don't ever talk about it. Right? It's never like, you know, have you done it? It's, you know, big ranges all the time, right? It's easy to kind of back yourself out of ever being pinned down on what did you really think and how did you do and did you get it right or not. In a profession full of people who are mathematicians, where certainty matters the most, it's like really hard to figure out kind of how to do. and I'm not saying it's wrong necessarily, but it is an interesting point. Yep. True, yeah. But I don't think there's anything to stop like some institution from emerging which says, we are going to certify actuarial skill and you give us the confidential information, we'll sign all the documents, whatever it is. We won't disclose any of that, but we're going to give you, you know, a number saying you're like a 43% accuracy or whatever it is, right? That kind of thing. You think in theory, if the confidentiality problem was the barrier, you think that would, you'd be able to get around that maybe? If there was enough demand for the product, for the service, being an evaluation of actuarial skill, which I don't necessarily think there is. And I think the uncertainty side of that maybe is a little bit more, or maybe someday it will emerge. You know, maybe one of you guys will be like, that's a good idea. I'm going to go do that. maybe not.
I just want to make a distinction. I think you brought up the point about, you know, writing cyber paper. I think that's, for me, that's more of credentialization as opposed to measuring skill. I think, Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the measuring skill here is more like maybe more of a backtesting type of thing, right?
Yeah, so, it would have to be. Well, I'm thinking of, so forgetting ranges, like my point estimate for reserve analysis was this, and my error band around that is, you know, X. And that's, I don't know, just to come up with something.
Right, but the only way to know whether you were, quote unquote, right or wrong is to, you know, reach ultimate and then go back and take a look.
Yeah. Yeah, otherwise your estimates to predict, you know, to control for estimates.
And the good thing is once you get to be about my age, by the time you get to that ultimate, I'll be retired.
Retired.
Yeah, and the people who need it most are the young folks who don't have a track record. Yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah.
Right. No, you're absolutely right.
Exactly. There's always new information. That's all. Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, something could happen. You know, if you're, for example, if you're looking at a workers' comp book of business, you know, which you know has a pretty long tail, and you know, something comes, you're setting reserves for a company, and then some law change comes through 5-10 years down the road, and you were perfect to that point, and it just blows it up in one way or the other. It says that, you know, all of a sudden you need to put everyone's, you know, average weekly wage, you need to increase it for inflation as opposed to what it was at the time of the accident. You know, your numbers would be totally wrong, but what your work would have been totally right.
Yeah, and it's interesting how there's a lot of talk about reasonability in what we do, right? And, you know, I named my podcast as a kind of an actuarial joke, Not Unreasonable, because that's sort of the standard of truth, which is fairly weak. But I think that that's really a commentary on just how hard the problem is. Not necessarily that we're trying to do something wrong here. It's just that what is the kind of the real error distribution or model error around a reserving analysis? I mean, it's colossal, the number of things that go into that. It's probably just too hard.
So as a quick side thing, earlier this year, I attended a CARE seminar, and I guess one of the sessions was something like, you know, Battle of the Actuaries or something like Battle Bots, that sort of idea. So the measurement of skill, in essence, in some ways, was just they gave three actuaries same set of assumptions. What were their estimates, you know? And so, surprisingly, they were actually fairly close, which I was surprised, and I think most people were as well. But is that type of, like, hypothetical thing a better measure of skill? I don't know.
It may be a competition.
Yeah, exactly, as opposed to, like, some real, because it's a lot of confidentiality that we run across, that's all.
Yeah, it is an interesting point. And you could imagine, you know, kind of back to this idea, like, what's the business opportunity here? Maybe it's a competition where you have actuarial students coming in and take a real case in history and have a competition and see who actually got it right.
Yeah.
Right, exams. yeah. Okay, so what time do we have? We have till
we have about 9 minutes.
Okay, all right. Well, that took a while, but that was an interesting one. Anybody else have anything to say? Here, points to make? Okay, let's move on. Okay, so information. So what information can you use? And so the underlying idea here is really important idea in the financial markets is efficient market hypothesis. And one important component of that idea is the market is right and you're wrong in the stronger forms of that thesis. And so one thought that I was trying to think of to incorporate that into the actuarial work is, so let's say, hypothetical example, whole bunch of workers' comp companies are under-reserved, and then you're working on a company and it looks like it's fine, but every other competitor is under-reserved, and so there's something going on here that's out there that you're not aware of, even though you're aware of, but you don't necessarily have any direct evidence of in this case. Does it make you more skeptical? Probably. Does it affect your decision? I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I think you have to, you know, use all the information that you have in coming up with a conclusion. You know, there could be something in those, you know, one or two companies that are just different, and you need to understand how much that difference really matters in the overall results. There was there was an issue in New York State about 10 years ago now, where all of these group trusts for workers' comp were found to be deficient, all but about two. So you do get situations like these, and they ended up shutting down just about all of them in New York State. We do get into these situations where there is a lot of correlation between the results, even though the companies, you know, the groups were totally independent of each other. The factors that were driving the results of them were leading towards numbers that were, you know, too low on a whole bunch of them. So you could certainly get into that situation. So I think you have to kind of take each situation you run into case by case, but you also want to make sure you understand, you know, you don't want to neglect the history of everything else as you're doing that calculation. You know, and you might, you know, and I think that does, you know, you do get that, you know, that word bias pops in here. You know, it's kind of what you're asking here. It's like, well, they're all the others are under-reserved. Could this one really be reserved correctly? You know, or do we need, should this one fall into the same spot as the others?
I guess one perspective is statistically, if you've got that many companies, there should be one or two that, you know, should be the outlier, if you will. You know, if you look at statistics, that I think for me, I believe in that, and that's just my general rule of thumb. If all of them were faulty, I'd be more surprised. So the second comment would be that I always try to reconcile, like, why, what's different from about this company, right? I mean, you know, there has to be some business reason, something that they're doing. Maybe they got lucky. I don't know. But usually some sort of reconciliation, I think, should be done. And then third comment would be, you know, I treat the advice that I have given, and I always kind of wear, like, my lawyer hat, if you will. Like, you know, as an actuary, I had to read a lot of contracts, so I dealt with a lot of lawyers. And, you know, so I follow their mantra of, like, look, this is what's given to me. I've vetted the reasonableness of the underlying data, so that's what I'm using, that's what I'm representing. To the extent that maybe information was withheld from me, I can try to see if that were the case, but this is, you know, this is what I have. And so you are basically doing your due diligence to your principal. And I think as an actuary, I kind of follow the legal profession in that capacity. And I think that, you know, that to me makes sense, but it may not make sense to everybody.
Any thoughts in the audience? I'm reminded of a saying or a story or a joke, I don't know what you call it, where if you're, you know, if you're rolling some dice and you come up with four, you know, I don't call it 10 fours in a row or something like that, you know, the actuary might sit there and try and calculate the probabilities and be like, it's probably a little bit better, more likely than you think. The trader will just check the dice. Is there something going on here that's unobserved but is biasing the result in some very powerful way? We might just kind of skip through a couple here because we are way out of time. Sorry, so I'm just going to zip through here. Okay, this is an interesting one. So this is kind of a, think of this as, we'll probably close on this one, as pricing, call it in a personal lines product. So there's an interesting example of a situation, again, from a Matt Levine email, where salespeople at this bank were selling foreign exchange contracts. And they kind of monkeyed with the price kind of after the fact. So you sell them a deal, and then they're saying, here's the price, is whatever cents a contract. And then 3 months later, you jack the price up, don't necessarily tell them or disclose it somewhere in a weird place. And extreme examples of this can be very misleading. But the thing that occurred to me is that isn't this kind of similar to a lot of personal lines pricing, where you try to attract the customer, let's call it in preferred auto, for example, and then you have kind of healthy rate increases over time in the policy. So they come in at one price, but they don't really pay attention. I don't know what you guys are like, but I'm a customer of Geico, and I have not looked at my auto insurance price in probably a couple of years. I am probably getting screwed. But you know, I just don't take the time and energy to do that. And this is an exact same example where the customers don't know if they're getting good prices, and they kind of don't care if they're getting a good price because it's not that meaningful of a financial transaction for them. And so sort of this incentive in the marketplace to mislead them or at least get them in at one thing, and then they wind up with something else later on. Is it right or wrong? Guys, a couple minutes left.
Well, you clearly don't have teenagers because you definitely
no,
care.
No, a few more years yet.
But, I think one of the things that you run into, and, you know, I've run into this in my own auto, is that there is a large, personal lines carrier that I used to have a policy with. And every time they lower their rates in New York, I get a call from my agent saying, you know, the agent that I was using, you know, she was the first insurance agent I ever had, you know, so basically 30 years ago, she insured my 1988 Dodge Aries K car. Yes, I'm an actuary. I switched to a different company, you know, shortly after that and have stayed with them ever since. But every time over the last 30 years that they've lowered their rates in New York, she's always come back to me and said, you know, hey, we've lowered our rates. You know, she hasn't told me about the three increases in between that now that they've lowered them, they're actually still. And every time, you know, I've had her do it a couple of times, and every time it comes up higher than the company I'm using. So it's, you know, I think that, you know, that is a question that you run into, and I'm not sure this is necessarily an actuarial issue. You know, it's more of a, you know, a sales issue from a, you know, from a company. Like, if you know that your rates are going up 20% on 1/1, you know, do you go and you tell people, hey, you know, you want to get this in by 12/31? We have great rates right now, without telling them that when they go to renew it, all things being equal, it's going to be 20% higher.
In some ways, this just occurred to me, and I'll get your thoughts here too, Tom, but our assumptions require that those customers don't actually do anything about that, and maybe there's somebody else that's cheaper, but in order for our projected rate change to hold, you kind of need the customer base to stay the same. Otherwise, you know, you're measuring rate change by looking at renewal policies. You don't want them to really leave, and so I don't know if there's an implicit kind of need for customers to not really pay attention to rate change in order for our numbers to work out better. Tom, any thoughts?
Yeah, my personal experience is that I think it's just part of the price optimization that goes on. And they rely on the stickiness of clients, especially in personal insurance. So I would have the initial price, you know, looks very attractive. Yes, I'll go with you guys. But then if I make a change, whether it's switching out autos or something like that, the price would increase dramatically. I didn't necessarily pay attention to it, and all of a sudden when I started looking back at some of the policies, the increases were like ridiculously high, like 50%, sometimes 100%. I would call, and of course the usual customer service is, oh, it's, you know, our rates just went up. There's really no information, no transparency, and now it's deliberate.
Is it wrong?
It's the way the market is, and I'm not going to be judgmental about it. So what I do is I make a big effort as my own risk manager to review my policy every several years. And I usually jump ship. And that helps me keep my prices lower. So that's just my anecdotal comments.
Yep.
I think auto homeowners, at least in the US, I don't know about Canada, are regulated pretty heavily by states. I know, for instance, Alabama's Department of Insurance has caps on for the amount of time you can have a cap on. So, for instance, if you want to have a rate increase and you want to increase somebody, people might have a maximum of 20%, you can only have that cap in place for a certain amount of time. So, I think the different states are putting different limits on the amount of optimization that can go on. So, I think just from an actuary's point of view, I just think you need to be aware of that and follow that. I don't think you need to do more than the states are taking in such regulated fields.
Yeah, but I think my point, though, is that they keep the same rates the same, but by my switching autos, that actually changed my base rate, and therefore that didn't apply. And they did that behind the scenes. So if you compare apples to apples, yeah, the rates, as you said, they're all promulgated by state. By making that change, that makes that direct comparison, you know, not even relevant anymore. That's all.
Well, we're going to have to wrap up there, guys. A little bit over time. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming. Not Unreasonable podcast, notunreasonable.com. Thanks a lot. You should listen to it. I am biased. Don't let that sway you.
Okay. Good. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, thanks for setting everything.